I wish that I'd been taught when I was at school. I'm an investor, a business owner, and a money educator. Understand it better, compound interest, cash flow, budgeting, investments, recover from debt. No one explained to me, put your money to work. It's about normalising the conversation. Everybody, welcome back to the Money Mechanics podcast. I'm Sarah Poynton Ryan, and this is Adam Smith that we're joined with today. I'm super excited about having Adam with us today because what we're going to talk about is a slightly different angle, actually, than what we've done on previous episodes. To give you a bit of an intro as to who Adam is my broker. So as most of you know, I invest in property, which means that I need lending and insurance and these sorts of things, bridging loans and all this sort of stuff. When you're buying assets like property or other assets as well, quite often what happens is you leverage other people's money. And I talked about this in the book at quite some length. You leverage other people's money. You leverage the bank's money. So you put a deposit in and the bank lends you the rest. So what Adam does, a broker does, is to help people to find the money that they need to plug the gaps. So we're going to be talking today with Adam about money, all things money, investment and so on. And yeah, let's see where the conversation goes. So Adam, thank you for being here.
Well, thank
Appreciate
you,
it a lot.
Thank you.
Tell us a little bit about who you are and what you do. Obviously, I've summarised it a little bit, but tell us a little bit more about that.
Yep. So my business is essentially, to like you said, I think you said it perfectly, find finance for people to buy property. And why I sum it up like that is because what we cover, you know, that's anything from residential, buy to let, commercial mortgages, like you've touched on there, bridging. Basically, if you want to buy a property, we'll find a way to finance that property through whatever tool or means or instrument you want to use. And also at the moment, we're also launching our business finance proposition as well, because many of our clients are self-employed or business owners. They'll often come to us and say, oh, can you get me a business loan? I've got, you know, I want to finance, you know, this piece of machinery or this vehicle. We just kind of listen, you know, for provide an extra service to our clients alongside what we do with the finance and the insurance as well. So yeah, quite a broad spectrum.
Brilliant. Thank you very much for that. So let's talk a little bit about money. So in terms of, you obviously spend a lot of time working with people who have a lot of money, actually, because a lot of the investors I know, obviously a lot of the investors that you work with are people that are building portfolios, growing all the time. What do you think it takes to be able to handle a lot of money?
I would say probably one of the most common things I notice between people is the ability to take risks more easily. So they're generally less cautious people. Mm-hmm. It's less about the negative side of what might go wrong, but more, if it works, what does that mean? That I'd say that's a common trait that mm-hmm. people that I work with that I would consider to be successful share that. They're less concerned about the detail and more about getting the vision done.
Yeah, that's really interesting. So rather than focusing on, oh yeah, but what if it goes wrong? This is how wrong it could go. We could lose everything. It's more of, well, it could go wrong, but if it goes right, these are all the really exciting things and the opportunities that present themselves.
Yeah, absolutely. And then knowing, like, you know, some people think, oh, if you've got a mortgage, oh my God, you've got this much outstanding. But then what they don't realize is what's the asset that it's tied to, you know, the fact that it's leveraged. You know, people, you know, most investors always refinance, don't they? You know, and take up to the maximum amount and like you say, build their portfolio, because the debt is not taxable, is it? You know, so a cautious person might say, well, actually, you know, I'm going to sell my buy-to-let property now because it's not making much money, it's causing me hassle. But, you know, I've got a capital gains tax bill of X, and you just think, well, that's just, you're not, your mindset's not geared up for doing it if yeah. you're thinking like that. So it's definitely, I would say, it's like a mindset thing of how can I leverage as much as possible mm-hmm. is a common trend that I come across with the successful people. It's not, you know, if you compare that to someone just buying a house to live in, they're more concerned, oh, this is the monthly payment, is it affordable? It's a completely different
headspace.
Yeah.
So I'm sure you'll have an opinion on this. So let me ask you.
Yeah.
We, as a society generally, what I tend to hear people saying is, I'm going to, you know, get a job, get married, get a job, buy a house, get a mortgage, pay off my mortgage, and then in my old age, I'll be able to live mortgage free on a house, right? Yeah. What are your thoughts on having being mortgage free as a goal for Joe Blogs public? So not the super successful people, not like millionaires. I'm just talking about standard people who are maybe don't have investments, but have their own home. As a society, being mortgage free is definitely something that people want and have. And I hear a lot, like that's a lot of people's goals. As a broker, somebody who understands how the money moves around this space, what are your thoughts on having that as a goal?
What I would be looking at is their overall picture. So do they have any other investment savings? Do they have a business that provides them with income? Because if your goal is just to pay off your house, well, you still got to pay for bills. You still have to pay to live. Mm-hmm. Is it, you know, are you really saving that much money? If you're a residential homeowner and your mortgage payment's £1,000 a month, that's not really an awful lot. So, well, you're saving £1,000 a month, great. But what I would be thinking about more importantly is, you know, can I build a business? Can I build some investments that are then going to pay me that £1,000 a month passively or semi-actively or whatever? That it's kind of like, again, it's like what you've always been taught, isn't it? You know, oh, you must do this, you must do that, you must get married, you must have children, you must do this. But why is it?
Yeah,
it doesn't. It's not always. It could be a good idea for some people if they've got businesses, other assets. Mm-hmm. But generally, for the average person that's working a 9-to-5 job, that's going to retire and then go on a minimal pension income or a stipend, it's just kind of like, it's not, it doesn't actually make that much difference if you're saving £1,000 a month in the scheme of life.
Yeah. Okay, a very short interruption of the episode. So I want you to get back to listening. I just wanted to remind you that the Money Mechanics weekly newsletter is completely free and we'll send this out to you every week. All you've got to do is find the link in the show notes and get signed up. When we send this out to you, this weekly newsletter is going to include things that will help you to become a better money mechanic. It could be things like what's happening in the markets, things like budgets, how that's going to impact you. And I'm also going to share a lot of insight into what I'm doing in my own portfolio and in the portfolios of the guests we've got on the podcast to really just help you understand what you could do differently to make your money work as best as it can for you. Make sure you go and find that link and get signed up. And I think this is the thing, like a lot of people don't realize that they can take money out of their homes and invest it in a different way. So again, like if I look at my grandparents, my parents' generations, being mortgage free is like absolutely the goal. And then I've got friends who are my generation and younger who, because they're in a group, in a friend group or whatever, where actually that's just what we do, they're also all doing that. And they talk to me and I'm like, you don't want to do that. You want to do this. Or what have you thought about maybe just doing this and buying something or put it into the stock market or doing something like that? Mm. And I'm always, not always, I'm often given the response of, oh no, that's too risky. I don't want to borrow money here to make more money there. And this, again, I think comes back to your point of the mindset of risk versus reward when you're considering leverage, which is interesting.
I think it's like every aspect of your life. People that are willing to take more risk. Let's take someone, for example, that has a job. They've got a normal job, could be in anything, and they get their salary every month. That person might think it's too risky to go and find a new job, because what if the new job doesn't work out? What if they don't get, you know, get kicked out or it doesn't go to plan? That's, again, that's a low attitude to risk. You're never going to progress. One thing is guaranteed, if you don't take risks, you won't get the reward. So it's actually, I would argue, it's more riskier to sit there and do nothing than it is to kind of aspire for something more. And the only way you will, if you stay doing the same job, inflation is going to erode what you're getting over time. And to the point where you'll be sitting there 10 years later going, well, actually, I'm even worse off now than I was 10 years ago because of in real terms. For me, you have to take calculated risks. And sometimes, you know, you just have to, even if you don't have all the facts, just take a leap of faith because actually the worst thing could be doing nothing at all.
You know? I think often, like when we think about the, I talked recently at an event and we were discussing in the room, somehow the banks have convinced us to leave our money in the bank where it is eroded by inflation, where we are guaranteed to lose money is better than potentially making money, potentially losing money. Somehow we've got, I don't know how they've done it. Best marketing team in the world, right? Because how have we been convinced that leaving money sat there so that they can make a lot of money from that money is better, even though we're guaranteed to lose, is better than maybe us winning? It's wild. It's definitely a conversation for another day, probably. But it is what most people believe. Mm-hmm. So where money is, where like investing or taking risks with money is concerned, like have you ever taken a big risk that's not paid off?
I mean, many times probably had more not pay off than did, but I can remember the times more when it has paid off. Even if it didn't pay off, it would have been like never a huge amount. It was never more than what I could afford to lose, because you've got like a capacity for loss, haven't you? Basically, in any kind of investing, you know, you put it, you know, you only invest or bet what you can afford to lose. You know, I've bet on, you know, if we go basic things, yeah, I bet on, you know, I like to bet on boxing now and then. And yeah, I've had some fights where I thought, yeah, no, guaranteed. And yeah, I've lost like a few hundred quid or whatever, but I could afford to lose it. So it wasn't the end of the world. But I'd say for me, the biggest things that have paid off is where I've had an opportunity. So I can think back to the earliest time when I was at university, one of the nightclubs closed on a Thursday, where everyone used to go. So I spotted an opportunity, and with a friend of mine, we set up another event at another club that wasn't open. Mm-hmm. And yeah, I mean, we were doing back then on big nights, maybe like $3,000 a week. We'd split half of it with the club. So you'd come out, and this was like 2005, six, you know, you'd come out.
How old were you then?
I was about 20, 21, 20-ish.
£1,500 a week for 21-year-olds, a lot of money.
Yeah, university. Nice work. Yeah, so that, again, and that was only the opportunity, spotting an opportunity and taking a risk where it might work or it might not. And again, it wasn't a huge amount to lose, maybe a few hundred quid, but when you're a student with like not a lot, it's quite a big deal.
Yeah.
And again, you know, my business now that I have now, I started that just from an opportunity spot when I was working at another firm, and they were all financial advisors, and I'd worked there for years. And no one did mortgages because it wasn't targeted. So you weren't rewarded for doing mortgages. And I spot the opportunity of working with 170 odd pensions and investments advisors. Well, actually, could use this as an introducer scheme and set up. So that's what I did. And yeah, don't get me wrong, first 6 to 12 months was the hardest, but every 6 to 12 months it gets a bit easier, you know, and you get better and better, and you build, and you start taking people on, and you know, all of this. But that's, I would say, is probably the biggest risk I take, because of the, you just don't know, do you? Nothing's guaranteed, and that's why you get rewarded for it, because the return on investment has to be big for people to do it. Otherwise, everyone would just have a job, right? So I'm trying to think of a really big one that's messed up.
I think it's interesting that you can't immediately think of it, because probably, and this is definitely with me, and I imagine it's the same, even the ones where you've cocked it up have taught you something that's actually been really beneficial. So you don't really see it as a massive negative. No. You see it as like, all right, it went wrong, but yeah, we got this from it, or the opportunity was this, or we went in this direction. Yeah. That's definitely the case with me. Like on all the investments, or you know, the people I've hired, the money I've wasted, the things I've done that really would with hindsight, like the wrong things to do, every single one of them, whilst it's cost me money, has taught me something that I'm really grateful to now know. So it's, it's I think that says a lot about your mindset to risk and reward, which is great.
Yeah, I've definitely got a high tolerance to it. Like, I think I've got the ability to kind of not think too much, but just enough. I think if you think too much, you'll never do anything because you'll talk yourself out. You know, I think the biggest thing I've learned, and this is from any kind of business that I've ever tried, however long you think it will take, double it.
And however much you think it's going to cost, double it.
and that's the reality, isn't it?
It's so true.
It's double the time, double the cost. And that is the biggest learn that I've had. Never underestimate the time or the cost it's going to take. Mm-hmm. And don't be afraid to do the hard work. You know, like it's people think, running a business is great and you're doing all this fantastic stuff. Yes, you do get to do nice things now and then, but it's hard work. You know, it's really tough, time consuming. There's no 9 to 5, Monday to Friday. It's all the time, isn't it? Like, I work all the time, but I enjoy what I do. And that's why now I've, you know, started to build the proposition of what we're offering for. You know, this year just kind of been a big year for us. Mm-hmm. Now directly authorized through the SCA, which is, again, been great.
It's a lot of work to get to that point.
Yeah, right. So, you know, it's a lot of time, a lot of money, a lot of like heart has gone into it. And now the next thing that I'm really excited about is launching this kind of business finance proposition fully. So I've learned as well, like you always have to look back from where you were at the start or a year ago or whatever.
Yeah.
Because I don't know about you, but sometimes you can think, oh, I just need to be doing more. It's not enough. But then if you look back now, when you started what you're doing, you'd be like, wow.
And I was talking about this recently because someone said to me, I was having a bit of a shit time. I was having a bit of a wobble because we all have them, right? And a friend of mine said to me, Sarah, 10 years ago, you'd have begged and given your left arm to have this problem.
Yep.
And it gave me a real spin on perspective. Like just in the moment, I was like, you're actually not wrong. Like I, 10 year ago me, so I've been running my business for 10 years, like, like almost like last week. So it's my decade anniversary. And like, it's been wild. There's been ups and downs, left, right, zigzags. There's been business partners have come and gone. There's been all sorts of things that have gone on. I've started multiple businesses, closed some down, won some, lost some. Like it's been mad. Mm-hmm. But in all of that, on the days when it's hard, and you know, even if you don't have a business and you have a job, when you look at your life, actually for a lot of times those really hard things that you're going through, if you look back, like you've just said, it's quite possible in a lot of cases that you'll be like, actually it's a good problem to have, really, although it's a problem and I don't know how I'm going to get through it or where I'm going to go with it or what it's going to cost me or, you know, blah blah blah. 10 year ago me would have been really grateful to even thinking about having this problem. So that perspective on it just helps you to navigate differently, I think.
Oh, 100%, 100%.
Mm-hmm. So let's, obviously you speak to lots of people buying houses for their own residential purposes, for investment purposes. Like that's your main customer base that you're speaking to.
Yeah.
I have conversations with people where they say to me all the time, I would never get a mortgage, right? And often I think it's actually just a misunderstanding of what is the best way to present your finances to get a mortgage. Because in reality, again, correct me if I'm wrong on this, but my understanding is provided a lender can assess the risk of lending you money and see that you are a safe pair of hands with their money, then they are likely to lend. Your level of risk, their level of risk might dictate the cost of that lending, and that might be affordable to you or not. But most people can get a mortgage provided you can present your finances in a way where you can show you're a safe pair of hands. Would you agree with that?
Yeah, absolutely. So there's different lenders out there to suit different people, you know. And what I mean by that is, you know, not everyone's the same. Not everyone has the same credit profile, et cetera, et cetera.
Yeah.
You know, not necessarily the same kind of income, type of income, whether it's employed, self-employed, whatever, right? So you know, what we do is assess your specific circumstances, then tailor that to a lender and a product. So that's why people should be using brokers, because you get to benefit from their knowledge and experience. I mean, I've got a case at the moment, first time buyers, Mr's credit's all great, Mrs. isn't. So, you know, I looked at it and I thought, yeah, it's one of those, it's not great, it's going to be hard to place, the interest rate's going to be higher, and I told them this. And then there was a lender that we do quite a bit of work with, and what we get our clients to do is download like a Check My File report. Mm-hmm. So you've got all three agencies, Experian, Equifax and TransUnion. I just basically said, look, download this report, send it to me. I sent it to one of the BDMs at one of these lenders that we use, and I just said, is it one for you? Would you do it? And they come back, yeah, we'll do it on this product. So it's like, even though, I mean, this credit report was bad as well. It was like, it was bad, like defaults and all sorts. And it's one of them when I think, maybe, like, I'll try anyway, because I want to see if I can help that person. Yeah. And they came back. We got a decision in principle on it. They've now had the offer accepted on the house. And the full application's gone in yesterday. So it's, yeah, I mean, you just think to yourself sometimes, look, there's a lender for everyone, because lenders, and I call them lenders, not banks, because it's more than just your high street bank. Yeah. They want to make money. They're in the business of making money, and they're only going to make money if they lend. Now, if the interest rates they charge are higher because of your circumstances, then that's good for them, right? They're going to make more money. So they'll always assess. But people will pay their mortgage first before anything else, especially if it's their home.
Yeah, exactly that, especially if they're at home. So what would you say is the biggest mistake that people make when thinking about, right, I'm thinking about buying my first house, or I'm thinking about buying a new house? What mistakes are they making on their bank statements that lenders go, absolutely fucking no way, versus where lenders go, do you know what? That's fine. We can get over that. Like, tell the audience what they need to be doing.
Payday loans are a big no-no. Payday loans.
Because it demonstrates poor cash flow management, right?
Yeah. So payday loans, excessive gambling. So not just like, you know, a little bet at the weekend on the football or boxing or whatever, like constant gambling can be bad.
So like multiple bets all day, every day, different times, things like that, that's going to be a problem.
Yeah, I would say, look, if you, nothing wrong with having a bet or anything like that, but if you like a bet, set up a different bank account for it.
Ah, okay. So the main bank account that you're going to apply for your mortgage on, that you're going to pay for your mortgage from, that's the one they're going to check. So if you're going to have activity, because there are people that like make their living from gambling and stuff like that, right? Definitely. So let's use them as an example. Your advice would be to have the main bank that they're like bills and normal day-to-day stuff, the mortgage, real life stuff, let's call it, and then other activities in a different bank account. So then the bank statements you send are the ones for this account.
Yeah, so like a fun account, like, you know, maybe they're, you know, something they got disposable income in, whether it's, but as long as it's disposable income, you know, and then maybe they, you know, they go out eating out or go and do activities, take cash withdrawals, that kind of thing. I'd always say have a fun account.
Fun.
You know, like, it's a, that you could spend on fun stuff. Yeah, exactly. And then have your proper account where you like manage it. You know, a good one to use would be like a Revolut or something like that, where you have to like top it up and that kind of thing.
Well, I have this set up in my world, not because of gambling at all, but I've got definitely not. I wouldn't have a clue. I don't even really know how to place a bit. I'm a bit useless on stuff like that. Investing, I can do. Foreign exchange trading, I can do. I suppose that's the same sort of thing, but paying on a horse, no idea. Like, I've got Monzo as my main account, and then I've got Nationwide as my joint account, and then I've got Chase Bank as my, like, fun money. There's no money in Chase because it's, like you said, it's I'm going to do something with it. Chase pays cash back on certain things, so I move the money there, then I spend it, then I get my cash back, and I move my cash back. So I'm always trying to maximise the spread of that money, like how I can get that money working for me. So even if I'm only spending it, that's kind of the same setup.
Yeah, absolutely. And the other one that they don't really like is Klarna. So if you're paying like you know, paying free and it's on a jumper or something like that for 30 quid. I mean, people would be like, what? But yeah, people do that. They pay for a jumper for like 30 quid in free installments and things.
I wrote about this in the book a lot. Like Klarna has a lot to answer for, actually. And even, you know, I was in, I was buying my mum a birthday present recently, and I was in like JD Sports, and there was a person putting like a £16 like t-shirt on Klarna, and I was like, if you can't afford a £16 t-shirt, you just wear the t-shirt you've got. Like, just don't have it, because you know, yes, all right, we spread cost and we spread risk and, you know, those sorts of buy bigger things, but Klarna actually isn't great for a credit score. It's not great for a lender. And also the reality is that, you know, oh, it's like, it's just, you know, £5 three times. But then if you do that and you buy 100 items on that, actually it all adds up. And I think people lose sight of it. I think Klarna's actually, and similar payment schemes are catching a lot of young people out at the moment, because you get, like, credit cards was my era. Like, we all just put money on credit cards from uni and ran up loads of debt. I think Klarna is the kind of new version of what that was for me.
Yeah, it is. It's specifically in like the sub 30 age group, I see. Yeah. So like what, the Gen Zs? Definitely it's them.
Yeah.
Our age group, no. But sub 30, definitely. It's a big thing.
I think our age group's more like credit cards, trying to get 0% balance transfer in, like living in that zone, because that's what we grew up with, right? But when you've got these payment schemes, and it's so easy now, you've got PayPal Pay in Three, you've got Klarna, even John Lewis has got like a Pay in Three, American Express now has got like a Pay in Three. It's really dangerous.
Yeah, and that's what I'd say, those things. Aside from that, I mean, people say, oh, you know, in and out of the overdraft, but it's not really, it doesn't really affect an application in my experience. Like, if you're in that's your overdraft, if you know, especially if it's not a massive overdraft, you know, like a few hundred quid or something, I've never seen that affect an application.
And I mean, most banks aren't giving overdrafts of like tens of thousands, are they? Like, no. I mean, I haven't had an overdraft for years. I've got no idea what they do now, but it's not going to be loads and loads of money, is it?
No, it's they're the main ones that you'd have issue, or loads of cash withdrawals, you know, like that's another one that raises flags. But yeah, aside from that,
so like where you're taking £50 out here, £50 out there as cash
every Friday night
50 at like 7 and then another 50 at like midnight.
Unexplained cash withdrawals they don't like, and then people putting deposit in. I guarantee you, if you've got 500 to 1,000, 500 plus deposited in cash regularly, they'll question that as well.
Where's that come from? Because
for like money laundering and things like that. So
things like Vinted and stuff like that now, when you take your money out of Vinted, is that, you might not even know, this might not even be a question for you, it's probably more of an accounting question, but would a lender consider that income these days? Like, if people are selling stuff like on Vinted as like
depends how much of it was coming in, really. So if there was like loads of it, they'd probably question what it was. But
is this a business?
But then if they've got their, you know, so they got a job and they got their pay from wherever every month coming in, they're probably just, and it was only if a little bit of Vinted, then they'd probably just assume you're selling things on Vinted. But if you were self-employed, then they'd probably question it more on the account. It'd be a case-by-case basis, really, whether the lender... It all depends on frequency and amounts.
Right, okay. So then also, there's a lot of people that listen to this podcast, I know, that are carrying debt, right? So whether it be credit cards or personal loans or car loans or all of those things, potentially. How do lenders view people that are carrying debt? Is it mostly around the maintenance of that debt, or is it around the level of debt that's the problem?
So it could be, so with regards to debt, it's probably good to distinguish between residential and investment.
Yeah,
investment, it's not going to have any impact on it at all, because
For those that don't know what that means, what's the difference between residential debt and investment debt?
So residential property, if it's for a property purchase that you're living in and they're basing it on your income and affordability, then it's going to factor into it. If it's you're doing a buy to let or an investment purchase, and because the amount you can borrow is based on the rental income, not on the on your personal income, mm-hmm. it's not really factored in, to be honest with you, the debt. If you've got a high street lender, they might not like it based on credit score, because your credit score might be lower because of the amount of indebtedness you've got.
Yeah.
But for a specialist lender, they're not even going to bat an eyelid on it, to be honest. But with people carrying debt, now, if you're buying a house to live in, they will do what's an affordability assessment. So they'll take your gross income, net income, and they'll extrapolate it to typically 4.5 times gross income. Then they'll take out the credit commitments. So what I mean by credit commitments would be loans, credit cards, car finances, student loans, that kind of thing. Mm-hmm. And then that amount after that, so the net figure they would use to base your affordability. So if you've got a large amount of unsecured debt, that's going to affect your ability to get approved with certain lenders. And what I mean by certain lenders is more like high street lenders. Whereas, you know, you can actually have a high level of indebtedness. It just means that you probably go down the specialist lender route instead. Yeah. But then you'd pay more for the privilege. Yeah. So these kind of things more rule you out from the high street than anything else. Mm-hmm. But it's definitely not a no, that's for sure. There'd be a specialist lender that would probably take it, like this case I just told you about.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Interesting. So in terms of, I hear all the time, again, in my education company, so I've got Money Mechanics and I've got Cogito Wealth, and Cogito Wealth is our like property education specific company. Yeah. And in Cogito, people come to me all the time, they say, I would love to do a flip. I would love to buy a house, add value and sell it. Mm-hmm. But because I'm in debt, because I have I can't do it, or because I don't earn enough, I can't do that. And I say to them all the time, when you're doing an investment based, actually lenders aren't going to care what you earn. All they care about is whether the asset can create the value that it needs to be able to repay them and make you a bit. So would you agree with my statement on that? And like, explain that to people, like why that is and how that will work.
Yeah, so I definitely agree with you, because especially if you're selling it, so you do it on a bridging finance. And as you just said, they're looking at the asset. So what's the asset worth? Mm-hmm. And what's the asset going to be worth once you've completed the work on it? So they're only going to lend if the security, i.e. the property, is what you're saying it is. Mm-hmm. And then when they get a schedule of works to what work you're going to do, they'll look at that and go, okay, so you estimate that the GDV, so the gross development value, so the finished value once you've done all the work, is going to be Y. Yeah, we'll lend on that. And the credit doesn't really massively come into it, to be honest, because the exit strategy is selling the asset, so selling the property. It's not really, well, it's great when you get, you know, cases like that, because they don't factor it in at all. They're just looking on purely is, what's the value of the property now? How much is the works going to cost to get it done, and what will be the development value at the end? That's it.
I think this is such an important message for people to hear, because so many people I see starting businesses that they don't really love, so they can earn money, so they can afford to go and buy an asset to flip. And I'm like, actually, you might as well not. If you want to do this, just skip to the end and just do this, because you can, you've got access to it. You can just like do it straight away. So I'm pleased that you explained that. I think there'll be a lot of people that go, oh, I didn't know that. And that's helpful for people to be able to progress doing the thing they want to do.
Yeah, it's just asset value is the main thing. I mean, you don't even need a job or an income. I mean, we did one recently and the woman's on benefits. You know, do you know what I mean? So but she's got enough money to buy the asset. So
that's all the matters.
Like an inheritance. So you're sitting there, you're thinking, they'll still lend on it, even if she's unemployed. So
it doesn't matter. No. Great. Well, hopefully people listening to this will go and be now starting to buy houses, which is what we want to try and do, encourage investment. Let's talk a little bit about like the education system around money, because you have children, right?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Do you think that education is equipping kids for, and your children aren't very old, but so maybe that's not, but do you think education is equipping young people today to understand how to put their money to work?
No. So my daughters are 11 and 12, so both at secondary school now, but yeah, there's no education about money. at all. None. No, it's not in the curriculum. It's not even a talking point.
And as you start to work with 18 plus people, like under 30s, yeah, and you're talking to them about getting lending, do you think that lack of financial awareness, lack of financial literacy even, is impacting the way that kids are, not kids, that I don't want to be patronising, under 30s are using their money today?
Yeah, but I mean, it's even over 30 as well. Like, it could be 40s, any age. Like, there's just a lack of, complete lack of understanding. The problem is, and you've summarised it, there is no education on it in schools. So it's, you know, instead they'd rather spend time learning about all this pointless stuff, and then they're, the things that actually matter, they don't. But then it makes me wonder, they probably don't want them to know. You know,
this is an interesting one. I've interviewed obviously a few people for podcasts now, and there's this common thing that they say, actually the world would be a dangerous place if the masses understood money properly, like we all do, because then you've not got basically worker bees working. You've got people who are free and independent, and then they're not compliant, are they? When people have got freedom, they don't do as they're told. So, you know, en masse, that could potentially be quite a dangerous thing, which is why it probably will never be into the curriculum in the way that would really benefit everybody.
Yeah, it's not in their interest, in the government's interest or whoever else is in charge. It's not in their interest to give people that education, is it? So
no.
And that's why I think the opposite is taught. You know, you must go and get a job and you must work there, and that's because they want taxes.
Exactly that.
If everyone was self-employed as a business owner and they all had really great accountants, the tax revenue,
no one would ever pay any tax.
Exactly. So it's the whole system is geared towards paying taxes to raise funds for the government. That's there's just no incentive for the government to educate people properly, and I truly believe that. You know, it's I've seen it with my own eyes. You know, they'll teach them other things in school. You think, what? And then
why?
Yeah, exactly.
So as a parent, then, what is like? What are the top three things that you're teaching your children about money now at 11 and 12 that you think is like absolutely non-negotiable that they understand?
You have to work for it. Number one, that you have to work for it. Like, it doesn't just float out of the sky, even though they may think it does. Like, you have to work for it. And I make sure they see how hard I work, so they know. And I like, always working, it's like, well, yeah, you've got bills to pay, got, you know, stuff for you know. And they understand it more and more as they get older, that it's not going to be given to you, so you need to go and work hard for it. And that's what I try and instill them above anything, first. And then once you do get it, you know, you have priorities, don't you? Like, pay for your mortgage, so you've got a house to live in. Then you can, you know, have some disposable income to then put in towards investments. But yeah, what's super important for me is like to get them to the stage where they'll be like 18, deciding what they want to do, and then to just say to them, start a business as young as you can. Really, I think that's the best.
Do you think starting a business is the right route, or do you think investing their money whilst working to learn how to be a specialist in their thing is a route that could also be beneficial?
I think it's child specific, to be honest with you. I think it depends on that individual profile of that child. So my oldest daughter is like very intelligent, very academic, so good math, science, etc., etc. She wants to be, well, at the moment, she wants to be like a psychiatrist. So you have to go do a medical degree and then do all that. That's great, because, I mean, I've got clients that are consultants, and they earn a lot. A lot. They're probably some of the top earners that I deal with, because they've got NHS work and private work. Mm-hmm. So I would encourage that route all day long, but, you know, say, yes, do the NHS stuff, but then do the private stuff as well. My youngest daughter, she's not academic, but I would encourage her to kind of learn a skill or whatever that skill may be, and then as early as possible, start running your own business, because in a business, like you said, you've had yours 10 years now, you've compounded in that decade. Imagine starting that at 18 and then
like 20. I wrote about this in the book. Like, it's devastating to me that I didn't know this stuff when I was 18, because I would fully be retired now. Like, if I work back my returns of like an average of 8% a year from 18 till I was like 35, I'd be very, very wealthy. I mean, I'm not unwealthy now, but I would be extremely fucking wealthy had I just put like £150 a month away. And let compound. I just done that. But I didn't, because I didn't know about it. And that's part of what the mission of Money Mechanics is actually all about. It's about helping people to just get there quicker. So that we, and it doesn't matter if you're an entrepreneur or if you're someone who has a job, like both, there's not one right. Everyone's got to do the thing that's right for them. But the understanding the importance of getting started, putting your money to work as quickly as possible is something that everybody should be benefiting from, because you know, I was speaking to a friend of mine not that long ago, and she was saying like she's probably spending £200 to £300 a month on like Starbucks and shit that she doesn't need. The banks probably wouldn't enjoy her spending, but she can afford it. She earns really well. She works for a big company. She's got a big salary. She can afford it. And actually £250, £300 a month isn't a lot of money to her. So I went through the compound interest calculator with her, and I said, if you put this here, and you let it compound for like the next 10 years, you'd be able to clear your mortgage, you'd be able to do this. And she was like, what the fuck? She had no idea. Mm-hmm. So she's now putting her money into like the S&P 500 and dividend funds, because actually that's way more powerful than keep drinking Starbucks. And it isn't until you understand it that you can really start to do it. And I think this compound interest is the thing that I think they should teach in schools at the most basic level.
Yeah, definitely. And like we've touched on that, there's a reason why they don't want to, isn't there?
Yeah. Because we'd all be mortgage free and we'd all be like in the Maldives.
There'd be no reliance on them. That's the thing, isn't it?
This is it. So in terms of, if there was one thing that you could like rewrite, like in terms of how society behaves with money or feels about money, like the masses, if you could wave a magic wand and just rewrite the way that it's dealt with, is there something that comes to mind?
I would say that it's kind of understanding the actual value of it, or how much you will earn based on how much value you can provide to someone. So you have to provide a commensurate, it's not time, it's not how many hours you do, it's how much value you add to solve someone's problem. That is the important thing. So, you know, if you can, you know, let me take an example, you know, could do a business loan, takes me an hour, you make £2,500, you know, and it's like, but that person needed that.
The value that you've given the person is worth it, the fee to them. Yeah.
So, you know, we've explored other options. There aren't any other options. This is the only option. Right. Okay. I'll have a think about it. Comes back a couple of days later. Yeah. Let's do it. You provided a service to someone that has a need. So you've created a value. Mm-hmm. Whereas you might have to work in a normal job like 4 or 5 weeks to get that.
So I can't remember whose quote this is, and I'll dig it out and I'll put it in the show notes before I release this episode. But someone quite famous said that if you want to earn £1 million, help 1 million people to figure out how to get what they want. So if you can add value to other people, they'll pay you as a consequence of doing a good job, in summary. And I think that's true. I think if we can think about money, like not money for the sake of money, but getting paid as a consequence of adding value and providing service and showing up well, then actually the money becomes quite fulfilling as well, because you're doing something that you love, you're adding value to the world, contributing in whatever way. Do you think there's a difference between earning money in a really fulfilled way like that versus earning money just for the sake of, I need to chase the cash? Like, in my mind, there's a difference. I've been in both of those shoes. Like, there's been periods of my life, like, oh, I've got to just build cash. Like, I've got none. I need it. I need to chase the money. And then I've had periods of time where I'm like, I'm doing what I love to do and I'm earning money and that's great. But I think when I've been in that space, I've had the privilege of having money first. So the worry of money's not in the back of my mind, whereas over here the worry of money was. Have you ever been in either or both?
Yeah, absolutely. There's times where you need, you know, yeah, you think, oh, I need to pay my bills, I need money. Yeah. And it definitely, if you know, if the focus is on building your pot of money, then that what you said there, the worry of trying to chase it, is lessened, and you can focus on making sure that you're providing value for people. So yeah, no, I'd agree with exactly what you said there. Yeah.
Amazing. Have you ever made a big mistake when it comes to money?
Probably. I'm just trying to think of one. It'd be like that question you answered earlier.
Going on the horses.
Yeah. It's like, what is it? Yeah, I'd probably. I've never risked more than I could afford to lose.
It's the number one rule. It's like we say it all the time. Never risk what will destroy you to lose.
Yeah.
And then you'll always be all right.
Yeah. So, and that's the thing. That's why I probably haven't really had any big losses, because I'd never allowed myself to get into that position where it would be big.
That makes sense.
So,
Adam, I mean, I could talk to you all day and narrow away to you, but at the end of every episode, we have a rule where we ask you a question that the previous guest has left for you, and then we'll ask you for a question to ask our future guest. Mm-hmm. So the question that they've left for you is actually back to the education system a little bit. Do you trust the UK education system to add enough value to UK-based kids to see the world improve, see the financial position of our country improve?
No, absolutely not. No. Don't even get me started on that.
It's a hard no.
Hard no, absolutely not. For all the reasons that we've talked about today.
Yeah. Okay. So leave us a question for our next guest. So it can be anything you want to ask them. Mm-hmm. They won't know who's given it to them, but I mean, if you watch the episodes, you will, but.
Okay. I would say, how would you like to be remembered?
Wow. What question. I love that. Do you want to answer it for you?
Yeah, go on then. I would say how I'd like to be remembered is by people saying, he always gave me the time of day, listened. That's what I want. He listened. Whoever it is, just sat there and listened and had a conversation with me.
He just made time.
Yeah.
Loved it. I think for me, I'd like to be remembered as someone that you could have fun and adventures with. Like for me, they're probably my two like most core values, fun and adventure, spontaneity, that sort of thing. Whilst I live a very structured life, actually, because there's a lot going on in everything I do. I think I try to make sure that I carve things out that are fun and adventurous and spontaneous as much as I can, so that I'm not living a very dull life in front of a computer all of the time. So, yeah, I think that's probably how I'd like to be remembered.
Good.
Great question. I love that. We'll ask the next guest. Adam, thank you so much. If people want to get in touch with you or connect with you or whatever, what's the best way for them to do that?
Either website, alphamortgages.co.uk, or Instagram as well.
Great. I will get the links and everything into the show notes with this episode. And obviously, those of you, if you're connecting with Adam afterwards, make sure you tell him that you've come from the podcast. Yeah. Then he'll know. There'll be some context around the conversation. And he can help you out with whatever you need. Adam, thank you so much for your time.
Appreciate you lots. Thank you for yours.
Thank you so much for getting to the end of the podcast episode. I really hope that you enjoyed it. I just wanted to take this opportunity to remind you that the weekly Money Mechanics newsletter is available to you completely free. This is a newsletter I'm going to send out every week to just give you some ideas around what's happening in the markets, what's happening at a global level, what's happening at a lot more local level, so that you can better understand what you can do with your money to make it work for you for the future. I'm also going to share in the newsletter what I'm doing in my own portfolio, just to give you some insights into what my ideas are, why I'm making the decisions that I'm making, in the hope that it will help you to make those decisions in your own portfolios as well. All you've got to do is find the link that's with this episode. Hit the link and subscribe, and that newsletter will start to come out to you every single week. I'd also really love to take this opportunity to invite you to drop me a review. I love the opportunity of getting to share these podcast episodes with you. It really helps me to better understand how we can do the best job that we can here at Money Mechanics if you tell us your feedback. So drop us a review, tell us the sort of guests that you want, talk to me and connect with me on Instagram, you know, talk to us on YouTube, wherever you are hanging out. Tell us how you're finding it and we can make this the very best podcast it can be. Thank you again for being such a valued listener. I appreciate you all and I'll speak to you soon.